From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Alec Guinness predicted James Dean's death to the day at their very first encounter. Peggy Lee and Truman Capote had an impromptu sing-along in the middle of an L.A. restaurant. Lennon and McCartney gushed over meeting the king of rock and roll, Elvis. Everybody meets people, but when icons meet, the famous and the infamous, it feels like maybe the earth moves a little, or at least our understanding of it, of them, Kipling and Twain, Madonna and Michael Jackson, Salinger and Hemingway. This hour on Point 101 Encounters of the Famous and Infamous. You can join the conversation. What do we see when stars collide, meet? What gets lit up? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Craig Brown, big-time humorist in the UK, columnist for the Daily Mail, contributor to Private Eye, and author of Hello, Goodbye, Hello, A Circle of 101 Remarkable Meetings. Craig Brown, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Very nice to be with you.
This is quite a lineup. I'm just looking here right from the nearly the top here, and you link it like a daisy chain. So one meeting, and then that meeting, one of them to another, Rudyard Kipling and Mark Twain. Mark Twain, Helen Keller. Helen Keller, Martha Graham. Martha Graham, Madonna. Madonna and Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson and Nancy Reagan. And right on down, I know you're a big deal in the UK. Kudos. But do you hang out with this kind of people? What got you onto this project, Craig?
Well, I don't really hang out, but I mean, I suppose over the years I have met some of them, as journalists tend to. And also, England's a smaller place than America, and so you kind of do bump into the Queen and things.
All right,
if you,
and
if
things.
You try a little.
Yeah.
The Queen's an interesting one in a way, because of all the people in the world, she's probably met the most. So in that way, she's the most democratic person in the world, in that her life has been really a professional greeter. And so in terms of hands shaked, she probably has shaken more hands than any president, because presidents only become president quite late in life.
Everybody comes to see the Queen, but you've got royal meetings in here. Some are affairs of state and others far, far from it. Princess Grace and Princess Diana, that one had escaped me. Where was their meeting, and what was the word that Grace Kelly, Princess Grace, gave to the young British princess?
Well, they met in, I think it was 1981. I'm now struggling to find the place. When it was at the very beginning of Diana's fame. She was only 19, it was her very first public appearance.
So she must have been nervous
after the engagement. Yeah, yeah. So she was very, very nervous. Mm-hmm. She needed a smart, it was a function for the Royal Opera House in London, and she needed a smart dress, so she went to the Emmanuels, who were later to make her wedding dress, and they had one sort of off the peg, and it was rather sexier than anyone imagined it was going to be.
Two sizes too small, she said.
Yes, and Diana thought, well, it'll be very demure, because it was black, and she associated, being only 19, she associated black dresses with demure, smart people.
Yeah.
But she hadn't reckoned on the huge cleavage it either gave her or revealed. And so then when she came out of the car, and, you know, Diana was obviously a complicated character, but you can sympathize with her at this stage of her strange career.
19 years old.
When she came
old.
Out of the car, suddenly all the cameras were going at her, and she hadn't really experienced anything like this before. And she realized that her dress, up until that, she had just looked like a little nursery school, slightly sheepish nursery school teacher. And suddenly she was seen as a kind of sexy thing. And I think it very much upset her. And Princess Grace, who of course was used to...
And who was attending this Buckingham Palace reception. And you've got maybe a little reading, right, from your take on it there.
Yes,
if you've got
it at
hand, Craig.
Yes.
To tell us about...
So she,
I mean, for heaven's sakes, what a meeting.
Yeah, so after the initial reception, they go back to Buckingham Palace, and Diana is upset. And this is a little passage from this chapter. As the evening progresses, Diana grows even more unsure of herself. It was an horrendous occasion, she remembers. I didn't know whether to go out of the door first. I didn't know whether your handbag should be in your left hand or your right hand. I was terrified, really. At the time, everything was all over the place. A reception at Buckingham Palace follows. The 52-year-old Princess Grace, the object of this sort of attention back in the 1950s, notices Diana's discomfort and suggests they retire to the ladies' room for a little chat together. Diana tells Princess Grace that she is worried her dress is unbecoming. It is, she explains, two sizes too small. Her experience tonight has suddenly made her realise how unbearable it will be to have hundreds of people always looking at her. She sees stretching ahead of her a life without any form of privacy. She feels isolated and fears for the future. What should she do? She bursts into tears. Princess Grace puts her arms around her and pats her on the shoulder. She cups her cheeks in her hands and jokes gently, "Don't worry, dear, you'll see, it'll only get worse." The two women return to the throng, there to mingle and to be assessed. "I remember meeting Princess Grace and how wonderful and serene she was," Diana later tells her confidant, Andrew Morton, "but there was troubled water under her. I saw that."
Craig Brown, course, reading there from A Circle of 101 Remarkable Meetings. Hello, goodbye, hello. And yes, I think you're no doubt about to say 18 months later.
Yes, no, well, there is a strange synchronicity. And of course, 18 months later, Princess Grace was killed in a car crash. And of course, the same fate was to happen to Princess Diana.
And you remind us that though Prince Charles didn't see any reason why she should attend the funeral, Diana, of Princess Grace, she was adamant that she would go. It was the first time she officially represented the royal family on her own. So many of these which had that strange synchronicity. I mean, here's two who could really speak to one another, even just for a moment in the ladies' room at Buckingham Palace, 119, 152, 52, and nearly gone from this earth. And yet that little meeting did take place. You capture it for us as a kind of passing of a baton almost there.
Yes, it was strange. And I suppose Princess Grace being a kind of coming from outside the royal family and also having that Hollywood background would have had a kind of knowledge and a sympathy. I mean, she was rather railroaded herself into marriage, and it was, I mean, her marriage was pretty complicated as well.
Yeah, yeah. Take us to another big one, Elvis and the Beatles. They were so enormous, and you remind us that Elvis was not all that keen about the Beatles. He was the big star. 127 in your book.
Yes,
He was the big star, and here comes this gang rabble from England.
Yes, and his career had taken a slight downturn. It had just begun picking up. But they were the great rivals. They were these kind of, you know, rough kids from Liverpool. And his movies weren't doing very well. He'd just done one called Tickle Me. I don't suppose many people would remember that. It was set in a beauty parlor, and it had flopped. Whereas their Hard Day's Night and Help had been huge successes. And so I think in a way with this, and it's also a bit like Michael Jackson and Madonna, with these pop stars, and it's still now happens, it's a bit like being a sort of medieval courts, you know, between France and England, and having to have ambassadors arranging for meetings. And,
both all big, but such rivals at the same time.
Yes, yes, and so they both want to check. I mean, actually, the Beatles had a pure hero worship of Elvis. There was nothing contrived in their enthusiasm to meet him, but Colonel Tom, Elvis's slightly weird frosty manager, wanted very much it to be them coming to Elvis rather than Elvis going to them.
And they did. He was in a Frank Lloyd Wright house rented from the Shah of Iran. This is 1965. They're heading over in a Cadillac, lighting up a little bit on the way over to relax their nerves.
Shall I read that bit?
Oh, well, sure.
Okay. Elvis is staying in a Frank Lloyd Wright house he rents from the Shah of Iran. On their way, there in a Cadillac, the Beatles quell their nerves by smoking a couple of joints. They arrive giggling. "We all fell out of the car like a Beatle cartoon in hysterics, trying to pretend we weren't silly," says George. They are led into the presence of Elvis, who is sitting on a sofa playing a Fender bass, watching the television with the sound turned down. He's dressed in tight grey trousers and a bright red shirt, surrounded by bodyguards and hangers-on. On the jukebox is Mohair Sam by Charlie Rich. "He just played it endlessly. It was the record of the moment for him," says Paul. On the mantelpiece, there is a sign saying, "All the way with LBJ."
And so they meet. I've got a little tape of that right here. Paul McCartney talking about that 1965 meeting with Elvis in L.A.
"Wow! That's Elvis. And he was playing Mohair Sam all evening. He had it on jukebox. He just played it, like, endlessly. That was, like, the record of the moment for him. So it was great to see, oh, he's a music fan. You know, he's not just... Because that was one of our big records at the moment, too."
But all this tension and the wives and girlfriends and Elvis's entourage careful to hide their excitement because these are the rivals.
Yes, and the funny thing is that Elvis's entourage, I mean, Ringo said, you know, people just did everything. If he went to the toilet, they went with him. But a lot of the Elvis entourage had complete no knowledge of the Beatles, and they wouldn't even distinguish between the four. They'd just say, "Hey, Beatle," and so they were very much the new kids on the block.
But the girlfriends knew, that part of the entourage, aware and careful not to put it too much in the King's face when the Beatles met Elvis. Here's a little Blue Suede Shoes from John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Craig Brown.
Well, you can burn my house, steal my car, drink my liquor from the old fruit jar, do anything that you want to do. But honey, they have to dance you. Don't you want my blue suede shoes? Well, you can do anything, but they have to them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about chance and not-so-chance meetings of the famous and infamous Mark Twain and Helen Keller, Salvador Dali and Sigmund Freud, Elvis and the Beatles, Madonna and Martha Graham. My guest is Craig Brown. His book is Hello, Goodbye, Hello, A Circle of 101 Remarkable Meetings. And they are indeed that. Rasputin and Tsar Nicholas II. Nicholas and Harry Houdini. Harry Houdini and President Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy and H.G. Wells, H.G. Wells, Joseph Stalin, and on it goes. You've got George Bernard Shaw, Bertrand Russell, Harpo Marx, and George Bernard Shaw, on and on. He's with us today from a studio in New York City. Craig, early on, you've got Rudyard Kipling and Mark Twain. And just to give us a flavor of how you treat these, I wonder if you might give us a good reading from that segment.
Yeah.
It's really, really something. This was Kipling, who had been, for years in India and would make great fame writing about that. But his hero was Mark Twain. And it's quite not a passage to India, but passage from India to get those two together.
Yes, it's a real case of a hero worshipper meeting his hero. I'll start the reading now. Mm-hmm. In 1889, Rudyard Kipling is 23 years old, though he looks closer to 40. He arrives in San Francisco on May the 28th after a 20-day voyage from Japan. He's greedy for life. He witnesses a gunfight in Chinatown, lands a 12-pound salmon in Oregon, meets cowboys in Montana, and is appalled by Chicago and falls in love with his future wife in Beaver, North Pennsylvania. Before he leaves the United States, he's determined to meet his hero, Mark Twain. He goes on a wild goose chase to Buffalo, then Toronto, then Boston, before eventually tracking him down to Elmira, where a policeman tells him he spotted Twain, or someone very like him, driving a buggy through town the day before. He lives out yonder at East Hill, 3 miles from here. At East Hill, he's informed that Twain is at his brother-in-law's house downtown. He finds the house and rings the doorbell, but then has second thoughts. "It occurred to me," he says, "for the first time, Mark Twain might possibly have other engagements than the entertainment of escaped lunatics from India." He's led into a big, dark drawing room. There, in a huge chair, he finds the 53-year-old author of Tom Sawyer with, quotes, "a mane of grizzled hair, a brown moustache covering a mouth as delicate as a woman's, a strong square hand shaking mine, and the slowest, calmest, levelest voice in all the world. I was shaking his hand, I was smoking his cigar, and I was hearing him talk, this man I'd learned to love and admire 14,000 miles away." Kipling is transfixed. "That was a moment to be remembered," he remembers. "The landing of a 12-pound salmon was nothing to it. I'd hooked Mark Twain, and he was treating me as though under circumstances I might be an equal." The two men discuss the difficulties of copyright before moving on to Twain's work. "Growing bold and feeling that I had a few hundred thousand folk at my back, I demanded whether Tom Sawyer married Judge Thatcher's daughter and whether we were ever going to hear of Tom Sawyer as a man." Twain gets up, fills his pipe, and paces the room in his bedroom slippers.
I haven't decided. I have a notion of writing the sequel to Tom Sawyer in two ways. In one way, I would make him rise to great honor and go to Congress, and in the other, I should hang him. Then the friends and enemies of the book could take their choice. Kipling raises a voice of protest. To him, Tom Sawyer is real. Oh, he is real. He's all the boys that I've known or recollect, but that would be a good way of ending the book, because when you come to think of it, neither religion, training, nor education avails anything against the force of circumstances that drive a man. Suppose we took the next 24 years of Tom Sawyer's life and gave a little joggle to the circumstances that controlled him. He would, logically and according to the joggle, turn out either a rip or an angel. Do you believe that, then? I think so. Isn't that what you call kismet? Yes, but don't give him two joggles and show the result, because he isn't your property anymore. He belongs to us. Twain laughs. They move on to autobiography. I believe it's impossible for a man to tell the truth about himself or to avoid impressing the reader with the truth about himself, Twain says. I made an experiment once. I got a friend of mine, a man painfully given to speak the truth on all occasions, a man who wouldn't dream of telling a lie, and I made him write his autobiography for his own amusement and mine. Good, honest man that he was, in every single detail of his life that I knew about, he turned out, on paper, a formidable liar. He could not help himself. As Twain walks up and down, talking and puffing away, Kipling finds himself coveting his cob pipe. I understood why certain savage tribes ardently desire the liver of brave men slain in combat. That pipe would have given me, perhaps, a hint of his keen insight into the souls of men, but he never laid it aside within stealing reach.
Rudyard Kipling there on Mark Twain as he's visited him, coveting his pipe, thinking maybe that corncob pipe would be just the thing to take on some of the immense appeal he saw in Twain. Craig Brown reading there from Hello, Goodbye, Hello, about the meeting 1889, Elmira, New York, Rudyard Kipling having come all the way from India. And then this great, there's very often with these, there's a wonderful kind of postscript here of how you remind us that 17 years later, Kipling was world famous. Twain had grown nostalgic for the time he had spent. And you say, now age 70, Twain addicted to Kipling's works, reread Kim every year, and said, in this way I go back to India without fatigue. The worshipped had become the worshipper. These cycles and circles that work through these relationships as one is rising in fame and the other falling maybe or the affection that
builds.
Yes,
obviously lots and lots of people, famous people have met each other, but I tried to get ones where there was almost like a little short story involved.
That is wonderful.
And I think that's rather a good example of just the way the worshipper and the worshipped kind of intermingle and
roles
change places.
Kipling and Twain, incredible. Gordon is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Gordon, you're on the air with Craig Brown.
Thank you for taking my call. I hope this qualifies, but I ran over Andy Warhol.
Ran over him with what?
A vehicle. It wasn't quite a bad accident. I just tapped him with the car, and he kind of sprawled out for a second on the car. I kind of smiled, and him and Bianca Jagger walked into Studio 54. It was right outside Studio 54 on New Year's Eve. It was very crowded. I didn't see him coming from that side because I was trying to look in Studio 54, and he came from the driver's side, and next thing I know, he's sprawled out on the hood of my car.
Sounds like it must have been a nice, gentle meeting, but nevertheless, running over Andy Warhol. That's a great story.
Actually, oddly enough, I start the book with a similar story.
Yes, you do.
A slightly more evil character. But I have this young Englishman who's just learning to drive in Munich in 1931. It's his very first day driving a car. And he takes a corner a bit too fast by mistake and knocks someone down. That person turns out to be Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
And this young man.
Scott Ellis, yeah.
Yeah, and he only died a few years ago, and he said all the rest of his life he said he really regretted not driving faster because he could have changed the whole course of world history, which of course is true.
Yeah.
That one meeting can change everything.
Yeah, Hitler on the bumper of his car in 1931, Andy Warhol's on yours at Studio 54, Gordon. Thanks for your call. Jane in Boston.
Gordon could have changed the course of modern art if
yes,
any had driven a bit faster.
Campbell soup cans, I guess they're already out there. Jane in Boston. Thanks for calling, Jane. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is really a great conversation. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about Khrushchev's meeting with Marilyn Monroe. How did it take place? Where? Was there a translator there? What were the circumstances?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's quite a story. She had actually learned a little Russian for it, you remind us. But tell us, Craig.
Yeah, it's a good meeting, I think. Khrushchev was the most extraordinary character. There's no one else like him on the world stage today.
Soviet premier. There's a whole generation that may not even know who he was or how prominent, Craig.
Top man in the Soviet Union, incredibly bad-tempered and incredibly and was quite happy to lose his temper in public.
Banged his shoe on the podium at the United Nations, famously.
And it was the biggest kind of press entourage that had ever been behind him. Everyone covering every move he made in when he made his trip to America. This is in 1959. And there was going to be a big reception in Hollywood, in the Beverly Hills. It was in Beverly Hills. And Marilyn originally wasn't going to go to it. But then someone told her that in Russia, America meant only two things, Coca-Cola and Marilyn Monroe.
Right, so she changed
knew
her
of
mind.
Her and she changed her mind, yeah, yeah. She was always known for being very, very late, but this time she arrived on time.
The studio instructed her, you remind us, to wear her tightest, sexiest dress.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
The tightest, sexiest dress.
I don't know what they were looking for. Distribution rights in the Soviet Union, maybe.
Well, I suppose they were trying to find something which would charm Khrushchev because he'd been so full of complaints on the right before. Anyway, and there was this big Hollywood dinner. And halfway, when he even started heckling the welcoming speech for silly Khrushchev. And then right at the end, Marilyn, after the dinner, he went up to Marilyn and was extremely charmed by her. She said, he looked at me the way a man looks on a woman. And Khrushchev said, you're a very lovely young lady. And then she had this prepared speech, which was...
Russian, which Natalie Wood had taught her a line in Russian. Why did Natalie Wood speak fluent Russian?
I think she was half Russian, wasn't she?
Okay, you're beyond me there.
I think so. I think she was. She could speak it. Yeah. So she says, "My husband, I can't do Marilyn Monroe's voice. My husband Arthur Miller sends you his greeting. There should be more of this kind of thing. It would help both our countries understand each other."
Yeah, she also had this line all set up for the Soviet Union's leader. We, the workers of 20th Century Fox, rejoice that you've come to visit our studio and country. Oh boy! All right. Well, good. Good.
And then she said afterwards, she said, this is about the biggest day in the history of the movie business. And so she was very, very enthusiastic while she was there. But then she told her maid, who wrote a book about Marilyn, she said, in fact, she didn't like him. He was fat and ugly and had warts on his face and he growled. And then she said, who would want to be a communist with a president like that?
That sounds more like Marilyn. That sounds like something we might recognize. You know, some of the meetings were so brief that you describe here, and yet they become consequential. The meeting between Madonna and the great dancer Martha Graham was really interesting in the way it all plays out, and the way two worlds and worldviews, or maybe meeting, maybe fusing there. I wish you'd remind us of that one. Greg.
Yes, well, to slightly change the subject, one of the things I like about the book is the kind of the leaps in time and the leaps. I have Mark Twain meeting after he's met Rudyard Kipling, meeting Helen Keller before he died in 1909. And then you have this big...
I love that one. She describes him, his talk fragrant with tobacco and flamboyant with profanity.
Yes.
And then Helen Keller saying of Mark Twain, I mean, they were both icons, so... you and others remind us, everybody had to meet Helen Keller. Albert Einstein had to meet her. She was just that kind of figure of her time.
Yes, I say she was like Nelson Mandela.
Right, everybody has to meet.
Every celebrity wanted to meet.
Right.
But actually, Mark Twain had been incredibly good to Helen Keller. He'd helped pay for her education. He'd got a whole lot of people to contribute to it. So he'd been a completely pivotal figure in her life.
I love the way she said, if I may just quote you quoting her here, Keller on Twain, he seemed to have absorbed all America into himself. The great Mississippi River seemed forever flowing through his speech, through the shadowless white sands of thought, his voice seemed to say, like the river, why hurry? Eternity is long. The ocean can wait. I love that line.
It's a beautiful line. Anyone who hasn't read it, I urge them to read Helen Keller's autobiography, because it's full of very beautiful writing like that. Anyway, talking about these leaps in time. Mm. So that's 1909. Then the next one is Helen Keller as an old lady being taught to dance by Martha Graham in New York in 1952. And then the next one is another huge leap in time. Martha Graham, as an old woman,
90
meets Madonna in 1978. And so you have these, you know, it's only, what, two handshakes, three handshakes from Madonna to Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Which I find really sort of magical in a way.
Well, and the way time collapses when you look at it through lifetimes, which are longer than we think. I mean, the greater part of a century in Martha Graham's time. Madonna, who turns out to be this big kind of pop music sex symbol. And you reminded, inspired by Martha Graham, who you reminded said it was Martha Graham's belief that female dancers should dance from the vagina. She was controversial in her time, but that's exactly what Madonna came
from. She was very kind of sexually based, and people found her very shocking at the beginning. But of course, then once Madonna comes along, who kind of uses some of Martha Graham's moves in her dance routine.
Absolutely.
Routines.
Shows up just a teenager in New York within 24 hours. She's signing up for beginner's classes in Martha Graham's studio, meets her one day just in a hallway. They don't even speak. They're just face-to-face for a moment. And then 10 years later, Madonna is the most famous female pop star in the world. She gets the word that the Martha Graham Dance School is facing bankruptcy. And the very next day does what?
Well, the very next day, they ask Madonna, her office asks if she can contribute anything. Next day, Martha Graham receives a check for $150,000. And this fierce old dragon of a lady, who's now aged 94, looks at the check and bursts into tears. It's a kind of moving. And I think it's a nice story because you don't think of Madonna in that kind of philanthropic way all the time.
No.
And so it's rather a sweet side of her, I think.
Madonna, after just a meeting in the hallway when she was the young dance student who had to get to the restroom, sees Martha Graham for a moment. 10 years later, bails out Martha Graham. Martha Graham saying she's naughty and dares you to react, but she only puts on stage what most women hide. And yes, it may not be respectable, but respectable. Show me any artist, Martha Graham saying of Madonna, who wants to be respectable. It's Chelsea Hotel behind us. Leonard Cohen sang it, of course. That takes us to Leonard Cohen and Janis Joplin. We'll go right there when we come back. Craig Brown is with us. His new book is Hello, Goodbye, Hello. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
You got a way I never once heard you say. I need you, I don't need you, I need you, I don't need you, and all of that jiving around, I don't mean to suggest that I loved you the best, I can't keep track of each fallen robin. I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. That's all, I don't even think of you that often.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about chance and not-so-chance meetings of the famous and the infamous Mark Twain and Helen Keller, Salvador Dali and Sigmund Freud, Elvis and the Beatles. We just heard Madonna and Martha Graham. 101 such meetings described in Craig Brown's new book, Hello, Goodbye, Hello, A Circle of 101 Remarkable Meetings. Craig Brown, big in the humor in the UK, with us from New York today. And Craig, lots of response online here. Inez writes, the Twain and Kipling story is incredible. So happy to have heard it. Giras reminds us, he says, at the end of Twain's autobiography is a beautiful letter from Keller expressing thanks to Twain. So you're not the only one who noticed. John wishes to hear more about the meeting of Donald Rumsfeld and Saddam Hussein. Yes, way back when, before they were at war. And Benjamin, much more currently, was struck by the image. You may have seen it. I don't know, but there were some big awards ceremonies. Your queen is not the only one who has them. We had them at the White House, Medal of Freedom Awards. And Benjamin writes, the image of Barack Obama, Toni Morrison, and Bob Dylan floored me a couple of months ago from the Medal of Freedom Awards. Yeah, when you see them side by side, I mean, there is something about just these iconic beings meeting that makes it somehow, Craig, much more than a meeting of just humans. But do they feel that at the moment, or does that fall aside? You've looked at 101. What do you think?
I think there is this, there's an odd, with famous people, there's an odd sort of small world of celebrity. Where, because I know in London, I've spoken to celebrities who say when they speak, when they pass another celebrity on the street, even though they might not know them or have ever met them, mm-hmm. they give a little wave or a smile, as if they're all part of
fraternity,
some strange
sorority.
Species. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so there is that kind of solidarity. I mean, the ones I particularly like in the book, the ones I was sort of aiming to get in, mm-hmm. are the ones where the kind of high and the low meet. So you'd have sort of Nixon and Elvis, or you know, a kind of someone from showbiz meeting some grandee from literature.
Nixon and Elvis is famous, but there was one comment you the president said, and we've all seen the picture. Elvis has got on his kind of super flash outfit with a giant collar, and Nixon, of course, is Nixon. Nixon says something like, "Kind of strange clothes you wear."
Yes,
and Elvis says,
he says something like, "You have your life and I have mine." Or
right, we've each got
like
our
this.
Bag, or you know,
yes,
you've
right.
you got your costume for your place, and I've got.
I mean, that was a funny one. I guess that Obama would be very happy to meet Toni Morrison and Bob Dylan, but Presley was very keen to meet Nixon because he wanted a kind of detective badge,
right? In the narcotics
badge.
Squad,
but obviously Nixon would never have in a million years wanted to meet Elvis, but his popularity among the young was at an all time low at that time, and Elvis had just rang up, rather kind of high on drugs, had rung up the White House saying he'd like to meet, and so all the aides said, "Oh yeah, you must," as a kind of PR stunt, and so they had this meeting, and I think it was a. He was like a creature from another planet, Elvis.
Yeah, for Richard Nixon. We've got so many here. And our callers have some as well. Gene in Cheshire, Connecticut. Gene, you're on the air with Craig Brown.
Thank you, Tom, for the call. My experience was I was an NBC page in New York City in 1979. And so you were alluding to being like that fly on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
John Belushi met... the Yankees catcher and captain, Thurman Munson. And it was backstage before the show, and each was enamored with the other. You would have thought that they were a couple of 12-year-old boys. They were so excited to meet the other. And they just kept talking over each other. And everyone around was just kind of soaking it all in. It was definitely a moment. Both were, you know, at the height of their popularity. You know, the Yankees had just come off the 78 championship, and Munson was, Belushi, you know, was in the fourth season of Saturday Night Live at that point. And
hot as could be.
I mean, it was a moment, and I've always shared that story with friends. When I heard, Mr. Brown today, I thought, oh, I've got to call in.
And Giddy with John Belushi and Thurman Munson, catcher, captain of the Yankees, 1979, and giddy about it. What about giddiest meetings in your 101, Craig? Who was really giddy to meet the other?
Well, I was going to say to your caller that sometimes people's responses on meeting famous people are inappropriate. Barry Humphries, who's a big Australian comedian, very big in England, and I think is with Edna Everage has sort of cracked America to some extent. But he said just recently, when Arthur Miller shook my hand, I could only think that this was the hand that had once cupped the breasts of Marilyn Monroe.
There's your daisy chain.
But I think one of my favorite meetings is Harpo Marx. And it was what I was saying about the kind of high and the low.
Mm-hmm.
Harpo Marx was once in the next door chalet of a hotel to Rachmaninoff, the great Russian composer.
Sure.
And they both wanted to practice their respective instruments, piano and, for Harpo, the harp.
The harmonica.
And they were both getting really irritated. It's 1931, getting really irritated by the noise made by the other. But eventually, Harpo, Rachmaninoff was saying, get Harpo moved to the hotel. The hotel weren't playing ball. Eventually, Harpo won out by playing this early hit of Rachmaninoff, which had really dogged him all his life because he'd never had a bigger hit. It's like a sort of pop star these days having kind of one big hit in their youth.
Right.
And so Harpo just kept playing the, I think it was a prelude in C-sharp minor. Major.
Over Rachmaninoff.
Over and over again, and eventually Rachmaninoff had to admit defeat.
Had to bail, get out. Musicians, we played a little of Chelsea Hotel, Leonard Cohen. Remind us of Janis Joplin, Leonard Cohen, in the Chelsea Hotel.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's an interesting meeting because it was I think it's the only one in the book which there was actually a song written about. Mm. And for a long time, Leonard Cohen wouldn't say who it was about. I mean, it is a really beautiful song, I think. But basically, in 1967, Leonard Cohen was quite a late start to his career. He was 33 before he just released his first album. Janis Joplin was 24, and she had become famous in the last few months with her first album. Mm-hmm. They met in that. I don't know if you've been to the Chelsea Hotel, but it has a very, very small lift. You could only fit about three or four people.
Tight elevator, old fashioned.
And as Leonard Cohen said some years later, these were generous times. Anyway, they met in the lift, and Leonard Cohen asked Janis Joplin if she was looking for someone, and she replied, "Yes, I'm looking for Kris Kristofferson." And he quite wittily, I think,
the very hot replies, young Kris Kristofferson.
And Cohen replies, "Little lady, you're in luck. I am Kris Kristofferson."
Oh, good
she
line.
Says. She says, "I thought he was bigger." And he said, "I used to be bigger, but I've been sick." Anyway, this, it was quite, it's quite a good kind of chat up line.
And it worked.
And it worked. And they got to the fourth floor, and it was clear to them both in that short journey up on the lift that they were going to go to bed together. And so, but of course, Janis Joplin didn't know it was going to, their brief encounter was going to be immortalized in a song, but it's a beautiful song.
It sure is. Give us more. We just want more. There's so many here. J.D. Salinger and Ernest Hemingway.
Yes. Well, I was very keen to get the two great recluses of the 20th century into the book. So Howard Hughes and Salinger, just because it was a kind of challenge. Because
who meets them?
They're famous for not meeting anyone.
Right.
Alas, they didn't meet each other. But Salinger had a. I mean, he was completely unreclusive before the war. He was kind of quite gregarious. Mm-hmm. Then he had a terrible war. Anyway, Salinger was a real fan of Ernest Hemingway, and Hemingway always claimed to be the first man into Paris at the liberation of Paris. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was there early, and he'd got to the bar and was the Brits and was drinking it dry. And Salinger came along. And actually, Hemingway was very nice to Salinger. He'd already read, I think, a story in The New Yorker by Salinger, and he was very encouraging. So it's a kind of nice meeting of two writers. And then I have Hemingway. Actually, the big challenge of the... Because the book had to be a daisy chain, I wanted it to be exactly 101 people. So getting the final link in the chain was always going to be... tricky, and I had
sort of
this
6 degrees of separation. You're trying to make your way. So if it's Rachmaninoff and Harpo Marx, then the next one must be Harpo Marx and somebody. In this case,
George everyone
Bernard
has
Shaw,
to meet two
go.
People.
Yeah.
So so sometimes people were saying, "Hey, there was a great story of so and so meeting," but unless those two people involved in the meeting had also met two people who were then going to be in the chain, I couldn't do it. But I did manage to get. I was left with having to link Hemingway and Oscar Wilde, and I thought, oh my God, perhaps there won't be. But there's a very good writer, more famous in England than in America, called Ford Madox Ford, and it actually became rather an interesting part of the train because Hemingway was basically taken up in a very nice way by Ford Madox Ford, and then was incredibly rude about him later.
1924, Paris, their meeting,
yes.
Or were they turned against one another? I don't remember. Often.
Yes. He just, it was quite often a disciple will turn on the hero, and that happened. But it also happened with Ford Madox Ford and Oscar Wilde. Ford Madox Ford. Let Oscar Wilde down in a kind of similar way. So there are sometimes strange echoes in meetings of earlier meetings.
David in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, David.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What's your story?
Well, I was in New York City back in 1978 or 79. I'm not exactly sure when. I had just played a concert at Central Park the night before and was spending the night with a young lady at the Plaza Hotel. And we woke up the next morning and went out to have breakfast. So there we were on Central Park South. For added interest to the story, I'll just add that she was African-American and I was a white kid.
Okay.
And so we're out on the street. We're about to get a cab, and there's a big melee on the street. The cabbie who's supposed to be in his cab at the front of the line is not in his cab. He was talking to somebody, and all the other cabbies are mad because nobody can get in the first cab, so nobody can start any cab
right
at all.
Right,
and they start a fight in the middle of the street, not touching each other, but just sort of
nearly
from 5 feet away, threatening each other and shaking each other's fist and yelling and yelling and yelling. And all of a sudden, I hear a voice from behind me say, "Now, nobody's punching around here. If anybody's going to do the punching, I'll do the punching." And I look around, and it's Muhammad Ali, who was champ at the time,
yeah,
5-10 feet away from me with 2 bodyguards.
Wow.
And he has been a hero of mine since I was, 11 years old. So I go over to him. The girl I'm with runs over to him, jumps up on his chest, and throws her arms around him. And he takes a look at her and takes a look at me and gives me one of those big bug-eyed, "I'm going to whoop you, Joe Frazier,"
right back.
And I just reach my hand out and say, "A pleasure to meet you, champ." And she says, "I love you," or something like that to him.
Yeah.
And, by this time, nobody pays attention to the fight in the street, which is completely over. Everybody's just gathering around, eyeballing Muhammad Ali.
Oh, I love that story. It's so in character for Muhammad Ali just to step right up and have something to say about it. I spent a wonderful day with Muhammad Ali. I mean, as a reporter, you get to spend time with all kinds of people, and it's amazing. We were in Vietnamese refugee camps in Hong Kong, of all things, long ago. But yeah, it's great to hear that story just about how in character he was. You've got such characters in here, Craig. What about
That's a perfect story of meeting someone and that person doing exactly what you want them
what
to
you
do.
What you want them to
behaving in character.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to have had Ali. I mean, he had a meeting with the Beatles, which I was tempted to put in the book,
yeah,
but I can't remember why I couldn't squeeze it. I suppose I just preferred the other two.
Our time is short. Salvador Dali and Sigmund Freud, tell us. That sounds so weird and wild.
Yes, well, this is Mahler had met Freud in 1910 and psychoanalyzed him, and then in 1938, Freud, dying of cancer, refugee from Vienna from the Nazis,
yes,
is with only a short time to live. Dali is mad on Freud.
The great surrealist painter of Spain
wants to draw him. Yes, mm-hmm. And so does go to his house in Hampstead in North London. And does this actually quite a good sketch of Freud as a kind of snail?
You have him at dinner, I guess, and looking at a plate of snails and uttering a loud cry. "I had just that instant discovered the morphological secret of Freud. Freud's cranium is a snail." Only Dali, only Salvador Dali. I love that. Oh, yes, and so they meet. And then Houdini and President Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy.
Yeah, I wanted Houdini. I really like Houdini as a character. He's so and he was so famous. He was as famous as Charlie Chaplin was a bit later, or as, I don't know, as Madonna or someone is today, probably more so, because there were fewer famous people to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
So he met Roosevelt on a cruise ship, one of two meetings I have on cruise ships, oddly enough, and he completely baffled Roosevelt with this magic trick, which Houdini had this great hatred of psychics, and was all because a number of magicians are like this. They know how it's done and they want to prove it's false. Anyway, so he did this very, very clever trick, calling up a spirit, and Roosevelt simply couldn't understand how it could be done, other than it being true, proper psychic, spiritualist truth.
Yeah.
But Houdini, the next day, told him it definitely wasn't, it was a magic trick, it wasn't psychic, but wouldn't reveal how he'd done it.
Well, that's nice candor with the President of the United States from Harry Houdini. I mean, the other thing that strikes me in all these is just how, I mean, meetings occur in time, and they're limited, and they make something great happen or they don't. You quote Jean Cocteau saying, "The earth keeps turning round and gets nowhere. The moment is the only thing that counts." Who made the most of a great meeting in your telling, Craig?
Gosh, that's hard to say offhand. I suppose the I'm trying to think of two writers who might have who might have gained some. I suppose I'll tell you. I suppose who made the most of it. Basically, I have one examination. I have because I try to have as many different types of meeting. You know, on a golf course or on a cruise ship. But Rachmaninoff, as a young student in 1888, had as his examiner Tchaikovsky, and Tchaikovsky then really took him up and really promoted him. And so I suppose that was the best chance meeting of the lot.
So there's a real handoff, from Tchaikovsky to Rachmaninoff, maybe something really past. We'll go out with a little of Rachmaninoff's music, and we will thank you for many great tales along the way. Craig Brown's new book is Hello, Goodbye, Hello, A Circle of 101 Remarkable Meetings. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Craig, in New York, thank you so much for being with us today. Great tales. Thanks for sharing.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.